reasons can be given, but there is one that I find quite apparent in the time and the opportunity that I've had to deal with people. And that is a failure to understand Old Testament Bible history. Since we don't understand it, we don't like it. And since we don't understand it, and since we won't take time to study it, to better understand it, then we'd rather just ignore the problem. Well, how well do you understand Old Testament Bible history? Well, you don't have to tell me. In the next few months, we're probably going to find out, all of us, how well we understand Bible history. The Old Testament can be best understood and best kept in mind when you divide it up into periods that will help you remember when certain things and events took place. One may get helpful lessons and spiritual strength from a Bible fact, from a Bible character, and may sever it from its true historical setting and lose valuable information by understanding the setting for that event or that character. When you begin to work a puzzle, the usual procedure is to get all the pieces of the puzzle out and assemble the framework first. Get all the frame assembled, and then you can fit in the pieces that go in the middle of the puzzle. In a similar vein, when studying the Bible, it always helps to have the edges pieces in place prior to your study by giving you a detailed understanding of a specific book, by a verse, by a character, by a setting, can give you a better understanding of how that can be applied to your life. This outline that we're going to study today is in hopes to do that. If I was going to be here next Sunday, this is when I would give this lesson, because this is when, a week from then, we're going to begin studying the Old Testament. And so before we begin, I'd like to give you some help. And I'd like to give you some help by setting forth an Old Testament timeline. I want to set before you a way of keeping things in their proper perspective as you study the Old Testament. You know, Romans 15 and verse 4 is a passage you all are very familiar with. It says, whatever things were written aforetime were written for our learning. The Old Testament is written for our edification. It can help us better understand the new. It can give you a deeper appreciation of truth, and it can give you a much deeper appreciation of God. And so I hope that this lesson today will help you along that line into better understanding Old Testament history. Going to have to bear with me, because I've made many charts, because it will make your understanding much, much easier. To begin with this morning, I want to show you 12 Bible periods. And we're just talking about Old Testament history. I'm not going to go into New Testament. I'll do that later when we start studying the New Testament. But I want to just talk about the Old Testament history for today. To begin with, these periods did not originate with me. This is not something that I thought up. This is something that I've studied that other people have set up, but I believe it's an easy way to understand Bible history. Let's talk about the first period of Bible history, the antediluvian before the flood period. This period of time is listed and it is given in 3-8 chapters of the Old Testament. Genesis 1 through 8 is this period of history. And it's called antediluvian because it happened before the flood. But to better understand each period of time, I want to give you some things that happened during that period of time. In that period of time, there are three events that are very telling about this period of Bible history. The first, of course, is the account of creation. How God created the world in 6 days, spoke the world into existence, and created everything in it, with the last thing being his greatest creation, that of man and woman and mankind. In Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2, you can study about creation, you can study about the design, you can see the order in the design, you can see the intelligence that it must have taken in order to create the world in the way and in the process that was done. The creation is very telling for another reason, because it sets into sets into motion some natural laws that are still in effect today. Those are called laws of procreation. And those laws of procreation are, very simply put, that each thing reproduces after its own kind. That is a law that was initiated by God at creation. It is true in the physical realm. It is also true in the spiritual realm. Everything reproduces after its own kind. The second event that's of significance in this period is the fall of man and the bringing in of sin and death. In Genesis chapter 3, we have the sad story of how sin entered the world. And we have the story of how man fell out of fellowship with God. We have the account of Adam and Eve giving in to the temptation of Satan. And by their own free moral choice and by their own decision, they decided that what Satan offered was better than what God had given them. You remember that God placed them in the Garden of Eden. God gave them dominion over all the things He created. He gave them the garden to tend. They had access to God. They had fellowship with God. And they had access to the tree of life. They could live forever. And all God asked in exchange for all that He gave them was of one tree that was in the midst of the garden, as we studied about this morning in our Bible class. Of that tree do not eat, for in the day that thou eat of it, thou shalt surely die. And we know the sad tale that Eve gave in to the flesh, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the pride of life. And she gave in to that desire, and she ate in verse 6. And in verse 9, she gave to Adam, and he did eat. And we know that beginning in verse 9 of that same chapter through verse 16, we have the consequences of that action. That God cursed three people, man, woman, and the serpent. They were punished for their action. They were given punishment. And they were given punishment because they were accountable. Because they sinned individually. Each were punished. That is a law that also is introduced in Genesis 3. That man is accountable to God. And that begins in Genesis chapter 3. And then in Genesis chapter 6 through 8, we have the biblical account of the flood. The flood was a disaster that was brought upon the world because of the evil that man was doing. In Genesis chapter 6 and verse number 5, the Bible tells us that God looked down upon His creation and saw that man's heart was on evil continually. And so He determined that He was going to destroy the people that He had created with a flood. And He was going to do this, but in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 8, we were introduced to a Bible character named Noah. And Noah, it says in a very simple verse in the Bible, in Genesis 6, verse 8, but Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And we know that Noah was commanded to build an ark. This is probably one of the first Bible lessons that your children ever studied, was about the ark and the building of the ark and how big the ark was and putting all the animals, two of each kind, into the ark, and how that was going to protect them and save them when God brought the flood upon the earth. And you remember that God told Noah that it was going to rain 40 days and 40 nights, and the earth was going to be covered with water up into its highest mountain. And you remember that the Bible tells us in Hebrews 11 and verse 7 that Noah moved with fear and built an ark for the saving of his house. And it also tells us in that account that it had not rained upon the earth, but Noah acted on faith. How faithful was Noah to what he was told to do? In Genesis chapter 6 and verse 22, this simple statement is made about Noah. Thus did Noah, according to all the things that God commanded him, so did he. He built the ark. He saved his wife, his sons, and their wives. Eight souls were saved in the ark. This age is often referred to as the patriarchal dispensation. This period is recorded in the Bible when God spoke to man through the head of the family, the patriarchs, and guided man with oral testimony that He told them and instructed them as they lived upon the earth. This period of time lasted approximately 2,500 years. What are some of the leading characters in this period of time? Well, of course, there's Adam and Eve. There's Cain and Abel. There's Seth. There's Enoch. And, of course, there is Noah. And so this is the first period of Bible history, the antediluvian period before the flood. Next, you probably can figure this one out. We're going to talk about the post-diluvian period, and this is after the flood. And this begins in Genesis 8 through 10 and goes to the end of chapter number 11. This period covers this period of time. And what are some of the leading characteristics of this period of time? Well, there's just two that I want you to be aware of. And that's the beginning of nations in Genesis chapter 10. In Genesis chapter 10 and 11, we have the account of the Tower of Babel. If you remember in Genesis chapter 9, when Noah came out of the ark and he made an altar and he worshiped God, and he was told to replenish the earth and he was told to scatter. But in Genesis chapter 11, man, as has been his nature, determines that he has a better way. And so he begins to build what we refer to in the Bible, and it's called in the Bible, as the Tower of Babel. And what he was going to do, or what he was striving to do, was to build a tower that would reach into the heavens, that somehow he could come in contact with God. He neither has the time nor the ability to ever reach to the place where God is. But that wasn't the point. God determined that the sin of man in this was told in Genesis chapter 11 is the reason why they were doing it. Were they doing it to get closer to God? Was that why they were going to build the tower? No. The reason they were going to build the tower was to make a name for themselves. They wanted to become somebody. And so, what did God do to confront and to confuse their efforts? He confused their language. And he gave them different languages. And in the process, man could not communicate one with another. And so, the building of the tower stopped. And these are the two leading indicators of Genesis 10 through 11 that have to do with the patriarchal or the post-diluvian period. This is still the patriarchal age. This is still part of that 2,500-year period. The leading characters of this time, of course, are Noah, his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And in Genesis chapter 10 and 11, we have some of the most interesting of Bible history, genealogies. Now, I know you all love genealogies. And maybe you wonder why they're in there. Why they're in there to make it difficult. That's why we don't like the Old Testament. What are the good of those genealogies? Well, let me tell you why those genealogies are important. They give you time reference. You know, you can add up all of those, and somebody lived and then he died. He lived and he died. And you know what? You can add all those years up, and you're going to find out how long the patriarchal age lasted. And that's why those genealogies are important. They give time reference. They give back where we can make reference to what period of time that was and how long it lasted. And so there is some benefit to that. But there's also one other benefit. We are building a genealogy. And this genealogy is going to lead eventually to Jesus Christ. And throughout the Old Testament, you're going to have an update on this genealogy. And you're going to have an update on how it's going to be finally traced all the way back to Adam, and it will lead to Jesus Christ. The third period of Bible history is called the patriarchal period. The patriarchal period begins in Genesis chapter 11 and ends in chapter 50. Now, this patriarchal period lasted about 215 years. From 1921 B.C. to 1706 B.C. And by the way, if you think I figured that out with my own little calculator, I didn't. I got that from the Bible timeline that was in my Bible, and I also made some references to other books of secular history. Now, the scripture, as you can see, is at the end of Genesis 11. This period is very important, because it sets in motion things that are of significant importance to us who are in this period that we live in. What are some of the leading characteristics of this period of time? Well, the call of Abraham from Ur. You remember in Genesis chapter 12, we're introduced to Abraham. Abraham is a very important person in our Bible history. He's going to be very significant. He's still significant today because in Galatians chapter 3, we're told if we're obedient to God, we are heir and we are of Abraham's seed spiritually. Now, Abraham lived in Ur, and he was told in Genesis chapter 12 to leave his homeland, to leave everything that he knew, to go to a place that God would show him. In Genesis chapter 12 and verse 1 through 7, we have the promises given to Noah, and they are very extreme importance. We will spend much time in our early study of Genesis talking about these promises. There are three. Number one is we have the promise of a nation. He's going to have a nation. Well, if he's going to have a nation, he's going to have an heir. At the time that Abraham was told to leave his homeland, he did not have an offspring. He did not have an heir. And he's promised that he will have one. He will have a son. And that son will be one of many nations. We're also told that he is going to be called the father of many nations. And so there's going to be a lineage. And there's going to be a nation that's going to come from Abraham's lineage. And another promise that is of great importance, the land promise. If you're going to have a nation, they're going to have to occupy something. So in Genesis chapter 12, he promises him a land for that nation. But the most important promise made to Abraham does not concern his son, does not concern the nation, does not concern the land. The most important promise made to Abraham is the spiritual promise. And the spiritual promise says, in my seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Not some of them, all of them. That promise is very significant. And it's very significant because that promise is ultimately fulfilled through Jesus Christ, according to Galatians 3, verse 16. We refer to that promise as a seed promise. It is a spiritual promise, and it is of the greatest promises that he's given. Now I want to ask you a question. Of the promises that he was made, the nation, the land, the seed, how many did Abraham live to see fulfilled? None of them. He never saw the nation of Israel. He never had a part in the land of Canaan. And he never saw the coming of Christ. But he perceived it that it was going to happen. That did not waver his faith in the least. Why is Abraham called the man of faith? Look at his life. Look at, he left his home with no guarantee except God said that he would show him where to go. The promise of the birth of Isaac. After he is left his home, 25 or 26 years later, he still doesn't have a son. And in Genesis 16, I don't have this up here, but I'll give you a little side note. Sarah decides that she's going to help God out. And so she gives him Hagar to have a son by Hagar. And he has a son. That son's name is Ishmael. And so it looks like it all worked out the way God wanted it, didn't it? No, because in Genesis 17, when he asked God to bless Ishmael, he said he would, but he said he's not the child of promise. He said he's not the child of promise. He says in a set time, 1 year from today, I will return that period of time to you, and you will have a son, and Sarah will be his mother. How old would that make Abraham? 100. How old would that make Sarah? 90. But God said, 1 year, you will have a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. Genesis 21. What happens? They have a son, and his name is Isaac. And his father is Abraham, and his mother is Sarah. And that son becomes a child of promise. He's the one that's going to have the promises renewed that he gave to Abraham. Genesis 22, often referred to as the greatest single test of a man's faith. This is a story that your children and you know very well. It is a story of a man Abraham being told by God to go to a mountain to make an altar, to lay his son on that altar and to offer him as a sacrifice to God. Now, you know what's remarkable about the story in Genesis 22? I don't read of Abraham asking why. I have a son. God told me to offer him. First thing I do is ask to take me instead of him. That'd be my first thing. If that didn't work, I know God doesn't negotiate, but I would try because I love my son. Do you think Abraham loved his son any less than you love your children? Let me read something to you that I think will help you understand Abraham's frame of mind. Turn to Hebrews 11 with me. I want you to look at verse number 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he had received the promises, offered up his only begotten son, in whom was said, "In Isaac shall your seed be called." Accounting to God, was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. Now what is the Hebrew writer telling us? You know what Abraham thought? He was physically speaking well past the age of bearing children. So was Sarah. And yet God was able, through his power, to return the time of life that they could have a child. If God was able to do that, then even if I give Isaac as a sacrifice and take his life, he believed God could raise him again. What does that tell us about Abraham? Faith. Faith in God. If you notice, the account of Isaac and Abraham is so touching. Because you remember, he told the servant, "You stay here and me and the lad will come back." I always thought it was interesting when I read the story as a boy. He told him he'd come back. He knew he'd come back. But yet he was still going to do what God said. And you remember, he's taking his son and they're going up the mountain. 3 days' journey. How long a time do you think that was for Abraham? What'd they talk about? Ever wonder? You ever wonder how heavy Abraham's heart was, knowing what he was going to have to do when he reached the mountain? Remember him gathering the wood? Remember him taking the wood? Remember the building the altar? Remember the question Isaac asked him? "Father, I see the altar. I see the wood. But where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Can you just imagine what was going through Abraham's mind when Isaac asked him that? Remember Abraham's answer? It's a classic. "The Lord will provide." And you remember, he bound him, put him on the altar, raised his hand. And you know, I've heard people in denominational world preach about this and say, "Well, he really wasn't going to kill him." But you go back and read Genesis 22. Why would he bind him and put him on the altar? Why would he take the knife out if he didn't intend to use it? And you remember when he was about to take his life, remember an angel of the Lord stopped him. Remember what was said? Now I know that you love me, because thou hast not kept back thine only begotten son. Now you know what's often asked about this? Why did God test Abraham in that way? I don't have an answer to that. Only one person knows the answer to that. You'll have to ask him, and that's God. This was Abraham's test of faith. You know what? I'm glad that wasn't my test of faith. Does that sound selfish? It probably is. But Abraham passed his test of faith. Then we have the sons of Isaac, Jacob and Esau. Couple of brothers. And these brothers are something else. But the story that you remember most about Jacob and Esau has to do with a story that's told in 7 verses. In Genesis chapter 27, I believe it's verse 29 through verse 36, talks about the selling of Esau's birthright. Do you remember Esau went out, came in, he was famished. Remember, he liked to hunt. He came in, he was famished. And Jacob was cooking some stew or a bowl of beans. And he asked his brother to give him some of the stew, lest he die. Remember what Jacob said? Jacob said, okay, I will if you sell me your birthright. And Esau says, well, what good's a birthright to me if I die in this hunger? Yeah, you can have it. But you know what? I think in the bulletin, and I write so many of them, I can't remember this week or last week, I talked about Esau. I talked about Esau being a here and now person. Stop and think about it for a minute. Would Jacob have let Esau die? No, not if he's faithful to God, he wouldn't. Would his parents, Isaac and Rebecca, would they have allowed Esau to die? No. You know what Esau did? He couldn't see past the moment. Esau couldn't see past the moment. Isn't that just like people today? You got this problem and you think it's the greatest problem and you've never experienced anything like it. And you think there's no way out of it. And then about a week later, it doesn't look like that big a problem. You see, he sold his birthright. And he gave up much because that birthright gave him a place in the genealogy. But you remember when they were born, Jacob and Esau, Esau being the oldest. And Jacob had a hold of his heel when they were born. And remember, Rebekah was told that these two boys will be two nations. And remember what God prophesied? That the younger, the elder, will serve the younger. That means Esau is going to serve Jacob. That was God's prophecy even before they were born. Now, this period ends with the story of Joseph. And you know, of all the Bible stories, this is the longest running biography in the whole Bible. It's told from Genesis 37 to Genesis 50, tells the story of the life of Joseph. But you know, I want to back up for just a minute. What grave mistake did his father Jacob make? He made a mistake. And that mistake was showing favoritism of his children. But you know what Jacob did is exactly what his father did. Because Isaac did that too. Isaac and Rebekah had their favorites. Rebekah loved Jacob and Isaac loved Esau. And so there was favoritism there. And Jacob repeats the mistake by doing it with his own children. And he had a favorite, and his favorite was Joseph. Now, there's many reasons why Joseph is his favorite, and one of those reasons are given in the account is because his mother was Rachel. And I didn't tell you about that story, but that's another story of how he married Rachel. And remember, he worked 7 years for Rachel, and then Laban, his father-in-law, tricked him and gave him the elder Leah. And then he goes back and says, hey, I didn't want Leah. I worked for Rachel. He says, okay, but now it's a custom in our country that you can't give the oldest before the eldest before the youngest. And so if you want Rachel, you're going to have to work another 7 years. You know what that means? He worked 14 years so he could have the right to marry Rachel. And you know what is remarkable about that? When you read the Bible account of that in Genesis, it says, it was but a few days for the love that he had for her. And so, Joseph is his favorite. And one of the most known and told stories about Joseph is his coat of many colors. Who gave him that coat? His father did. And if you read Genesis chapter 37, it caused his brethren to hate him and not to be able to talk in peace with him. But you know, something else we find out about Joseph in Genesis 37, he's a dreamer. And what I mean by a dreamer is he has the ability to see things and have visions and be able to interpret these visions. And he has this vision that he tells his father and he tells his brother of they're all bowing down to him and worshiping him. His father rebukes him, but it says he kept it in his heart, but it caused his brothers to hate him. But you remember what happens. He sent out in the field to check on his brothers. And his brothers see him coming. And let's say, let's do away with this dreamer. And let's be rid of him. But you remember one of the brothers took up for him. His brother Reuben. said, oh no, we can't kill him. We got to spare his life. And so what do? They cast him in a pit. And after they cast him in a pit, they saw some travelers coming by. Who were they? Ishmaelites. Here's Ishmael. Here's the descendants of Ishmael. And they're going to sell him into slavery. Well, let me ask you something. What would cause brothers to sell their own brother into slavery? How deep was their hatred for Joseph? Let me ask you something. Does Jacob bear any blame for that? Yes. Because of his favoritism, he caused them to hate him. That doesn't justify what they did, but Jacob's partly to blame. But what are they going to do about Joseph? What are they going to do about Jacob? What are they going to tell him? They just can't say, well, we don't know where he's at. Then we have the coat of many colors again. They take it, and they dip it in goat's blood, and they give it to the father, and they let his father's imagination run away. And what did they conclude? That a wild beast has found Joseph and has torn him up and devoured him, and all that's left is his tunic of many colors. Do you remember the grief that caused Jacob? What did the Bible say in Genesis 37? He says, I will grieve to my grave. And they tried to comfort him, and they couldn't comfort him. But you know what's sad about that story? How much did they love their father? He was grieving, and they knew that he didn't have to grieve because Joseph was alive, and they could have kept him from grieving. And yet, they allowed him to grieve. I ran out of room on this chart, but the G would have been on this chart, was the story of the reuniting of Joseph and his brothers. You remember what happened? You know, Joseph is the greatest example of God's providence in the Bible. You don't see God's name, but you see it in every chapter that you read about Joseph. You remember Potiphar's wife? He was placed eventually in a position of authority. Potiphar's wife thought Joseph was a good-looking guy, and so she wanted to commit adultery with him. But he kept begging off. He kept resisting her. And he makes a statement in Genesis 39. He says, how can I do this great sin against God? And how can I sin against my master? He's put all this in his house under his control, and he's put me in charge of everything except you. How could I do this great sin against God and against him? And so she wasn't going to be denied. She grabbed him. He ran, but she tore off his loincloth. So what happened? She gave it to her husband and said that he had tried to proposition her. He tried to assault her. And like any good husband, instead he gets the facts, he goes off in a rage and he throws Joseph into prison. How long is he there? He's there 2 years. But you know why he's there 2 years too long? Because while he's in there was two servants that were of the household of Pharaoh who had been placed in there, the baker and the butler. And you remember that they had dreams and it troubled them and they couldn't understand their dream, but Joseph interpreted their dream. And Joseph interpreted that the butler would have his place returned and he would be given back into the king's honor again. But the baker, 3 days later, was going to be taken out and hung, and his carcass would be fed to the birds. Well, that's one good dream, one bad dream. But you know what? 3 days later, it's the king's birthday. The butler is returned to his position. The baker is taken out and hung. Do you remember what he asked the butler when he interpreted his dream? Do you remember what he asked him? He says, when you go before the king, don't forget about me. And true to his word, he forgot. 2 years he forgot. And then Pharaoh had a dream. And Pharaoh's dream was about 7 years of good and 7 years of plenty and a famine that was going to come upon the land. And none of his sorcerers and none of his magicians and none of his wise men could tell the dream. And then the butler had his memory restored. He remembered Joseph. And so he goes to Pharaoh. He says, hey, wait a minute. I know a man that can interpret your dream. He's down in the prison. And then he recounts how he told the butler and the baker about what was going to happen to them. And you remember, they bring him up, clean him up, put him before And you know, again, God comes to the forefront here. He says, I hear that you can interpret visions. I've had this dream. He says, I cannot do it, but God can do it, and He's given me the ability. Tell me your dream, and God will tell you the interpretation of it. You see, Joseph, even though he's been unrighteously put in prison, even though he suffered for 2 years, it has not wavered his faith any. Not any. And so he tells Pharaoh his dream. And so Pharaoh says, you know, I've got to prepare for this 7 years of famine. I need to find somebody that will oversee this work. Who's the logical choice? Joseph. And so Joseph is put second in command in the land of Egypt, which was the most powerful nation on the earth at that time. And he oversees the gathering of grain for 7 years in storehouses for when the 7 years of famine come. You know what happens. They run out of food down in Canaan. They're going to have to go to Egypt to get it. And so Jacob sends his brothers, except Benjamin, to get the grain. Who do they have to see to get the grain? Joseph. Do they recognize him? No. But Joseph recognizes them. And it says when he saw them, he had to turn away and wept. And you remember how the story goes, how back and forth he wants to know, he asks all these questions. But you know the thing that was really puzzling to the brothers was when he invited them back to the house and he set them at the table and he set them exactly how they were according to their age. Well, how he knew that? You know, that perplexed him how he knew that. But you know, finally he gets Benjamin down there. But ask yourself this question about Joseph. Why didn't he get revenge? He certainly was in a position to do it. He could have had them cast in prison. They would have never got out. Why didn't he do it? Let me end our discussion this morning. We'll pick this up tonight. I want to read a passage with you that's very telling about this man. Turn to Genesis chapter 50. Jacob has died, and now the brothers fear that Joseph will now take his vengeance since his father is dead. And they come down and they pray for mercy. I want you to look at the statement that Joseph makes in verse number 19. Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God?" What does he mean? Does vengeance belong to me? Is that my place? Joseph knew it was not. Look at the very next verse. "But for you, you meant it evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive." You don't believe in the providence of God? I certainly do. And Joseph would be my exhibit A as providence of God. But Joseph's faith, even in difficulty, did not waver. He didn't blame God. He didn't wallow in self-pity. He didn't ask for vengeance on his brothers. He gave forgiveness. The only greater example of forgiveness in the Bible is that Jesus bestows upon us. And so that's the first three periods of Old Testament history, and we've just touched the garment. Tonight, we'll talk about the other nine. And by the way, it won't take as long for the other nine, so don't worry that we'll be here a long time tonight. But tonight, we'll talk about the other nine. There are 12. If you're here this morning, and you're not a Christian, I've not talked very much this morning about what you need to do to be saved. But believe it or not, the things that I've talked about this morning, they set the stage for you even being able to be in a position that you could gain forgiveness of your sin. You see, it's by the man Abraham that all the nations of the earth would be blessed, and that would take place through the seed of Jesus Christ. And because of Christ and him being in the lineage of Abraham, if you read Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, you have the opportunity of gaining forgiveness of your sin by hearing the word of God, by believing it, by repenting of your sin, by confessing Christ, and by being buried in the watery grave of baptism for the remission of your sin. This is God's plan, that you might come in contact with the blood of Christ and that you might have your sins forgiven. If you're here and you are a child of God, you've already done that, but you have not lived your life acceptable before Him, we want to encourage you that you can repent of that sin. You can pray and ask God to forgive you, and He has promised that He will do that. It is your soul, it's your choice, it's your decision, and we give you this opportunity to make it as together we stand and sing.